The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Jason Phipps, and welcome to a special edition of Tech Weekly. This week, we have hijacked our sister podcast, that's The Guardian's Sustainable Business Podcast, and their latest edition, presented by The Guardian's Hugh Muir, which focuses on the role of technology in empowering the young in the developing world. Technology and digital tools, as we know, can be hugely empowering for young people. But should the so-called developed world impose its tech agenda on many of the world's developing economies and digital cultures? Hugh is joined by an expert panel to discuss how to get this global, technological and creative exchange just right.
Hello and welcome. My name's Hugh Muir. Today we're looking at the impact of technology on children in the developing world. How can laptops, mobiles, and access to the internet empower children and young people? What are the challenges bringing connectivity to remote regions and urban slums? And once the infrastructure is in place, how to make it sustainable? We'll seek some answers in just a moment. This is The Guardian Sustainable Business Podcast. And with me to discuss this potentially game-changing topic are four champions of education technology. They are from Italy, Giulio D'Amico, Vice President of Business Development at One Laptop Per Child. In Fort Collins, Colorado is Renee Whitmire, Head of Social Impact for Intel. Down the line from Sweden, Christopher Fabian, Co-Lead of Innovation at UNICEF. And here in the studio is Gavin Patterson, Managing Director of the UK-based charity Yellowbrick. Welcome to all of you. Now, the writer Douglas Adam once described technology as a word that describes something that doesn't work yet. And with that in mind, let's talk about some of the challenges providing suitable technology solutions. And we'll start in the classroom. Julia, you've been part of the team behind One Laptop Per Child since its inception. And of course, that's quite an ambitious mission. Give us a sense of the ways technology can benefit young people.
I'd like to point out, a country like Uruguay, where since 2010, Uruguay has adopted the program One Laptop Per Child, and they clearly have been saturating the overall country at 101 level from primary school to secondary school with one of our devices. And by starting simply with what they thought wouldn't be just bridging a digital divide, by providing technology and connectivity across the overall country, what they actually realized was that this program, One Laptop Per Child, was bringing much more than technology and education per se. It was actually accelerating the overall development of the country, creating social inclusion, creating an entire different methodology of new ways of learning from a teacher's perspective to a child perspective, but also new economies that somehow have been growing inside the country from a social entrepreneurship point of view.
So real and tangible benefits. Christopher, can you tell me, do you find a similar success rate at UNICEF?
Well, our team has a phenomenal failure rate. In the innovation unit in New York has a failure rate almost in every project we try to build for places that aren't in New York. What we do find, though, is if we're able to look at how the solutions can fit in with environments and build those solutions in the places where they're most needed, we end up having some great successes. We think that one of the biggest barriers to success in projects that have to do with education, learning, or provision of basic services in some of the most difficult operating environments really are issues of scale. It's very easy to do a project that affects 10,000 or 100,000 people, but when we're looking at the number of people who need access to education and access to learning, much less access to medicine, basic healthcare, and we're looking at hundreds of millions of people, or billions of people, we have a serious set of issues to confront, and we know that those issues can't all be met if we build things in New York or in Boston or Geneva.
So we heard from Julia about the One Laptop Per Child approach. Is that too big to be to really make an impact, do you think?
Well, I think that the OLPC approach has changed the thinking in how hardware manufacturers make devices. But I remember when Nicholas Negroponte started talking about OLPC years ago, he was talking about 150 million laptops, and I think that they reached 2.5 million at this point, which really is dwarfed by the sort of explosion of mobile phones over the same time. And what our team sees over and over again is that if you look at how you can leverage things that are in ecosystems, you can create exponential change that lasts long past an initial engagement.
So, Julie, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do understand that, yes, indeed, as a nonprofit, we reach only 2.5 million kids, so we distributed those laptops. We impacted a population of 50 million people around the world. We see countries like Uruguay, where it's not at 10,000, but it's almost a million laptops that are changing the overall country. We do understand that there is a problem in terms of scalability, and if we have been disruptive in 2007 from an hardware perspective, we are now in 2013 with a completely new ecosystem, and we are focusing specifically on a software platform, on an educational ecosystem that can run on any device. So we pretty much have become more hardware agnostic, and we believe scalability can be reached only if the hardware pieces are going down, the hardware components are going down. So if Africa is gonna get covered with mobile phone, it's very hard to do any sort of education through a mobile phone. Though if you have a good user interface with educational content, at that point you can really try to make a difference. And this is what we are focusing on, and this is actually the new device that we are launching in a week in the U.S.,
So I suppose everyone makes their contribution in their own way. Gavin Patterson, tell us a little bit about Yellow Brick. How do you decide when a project is working or when it should be pulled? What's the yardstick?
We tend to build our projects with our relationships very slowly. So we operate with existing charities already working in schools. We don't tend to wade in with a lot of technology. What we do is we drip feed content and technology and build a relationship with that charity and with that school to make sure that we don't throw good money after bad. So if a project isn't working correctly, then we wouldn't continue the relationship, and we would focus our resources, which are limited, of course, on those schools and those charities which are proven to show results.
What kind of challenges do you face?
There's a whole multitude of challenges we face. As a literacy charity, we use digital content, and obviously deploying that content on digital devices has a whole rake of problems. But actually, one of the biggest issues we face is appropriate content and appropriate digital content. And when I say digital content, I'm talking, in our case, mostly about e-books. We often find that there's not content in appropriate languages or with the right cultural references.
So there's a lot to think about, but what does success actually look like in this area? Rene Whitmire, can you tell us about a project that Intel have been involved in that you feel has been a success?
Yeah, so when we look at technologies and the role of technologies in the classroom, we see it as one component of a broader education transformation process. So we've done a lot of work in the process of training teachers to really think about how can you use technologies meaningfully in the classroom. To date, we've trained more than 10 million teachers. And it's not just about here's how you use computers in the classroom. It's really thinking about the pedagogy that they're using to deliver 21st century learning skills for students. So when I think about how we approach it more broadly, we see technology as one piece, but we also see teacher professional development as critical, research, monitoring, and evaluation as critical, content, working with policymakers, and really thinking about delivering 21st century learning skills, as well as digital literacy tools.
Well, we'll come on to teacher training in just a moment, but of course there's always the issue of what technology ends up in developing countries. And Gavin, the technology investor Donald Clark said recently that we should think twice about sending tablet PCs to Africa. He said they're difficult to type on and inhibit literacy as kids end up writing shorter sentences. Is there enough thought going into the types of technologies that we're sending?
Well, the way we approach it is the learning outcomes we're targeting. So for us, the technology or the device is really come out of that process. So we focus on literacy because all of the other subjects rely on a certain level of literacy, which often isn't there in a lot of the projects where we operate. So we look at the learning outcomes we're trying to achieve. We'll look at the infrastructure at that particular school, how well connected they are. And often we are forced to work mostly offline. And then we decide, you know, what is the best device to deliver the learning outcomes we're looking to achieve. So if that's a tablet, we might well use a tablet. But it's, you know, we don't exclusively use any type of device. I don't really accept that children spelling incorrectly it has a big impact on literacy. I think the fact that they're on social networking sites and communicating will have a much better impact on the way they can communicate as adults. And I think that's probably the most important thing.
Julia, we ran a recent article on the Guardian's Global Development website that in which one of your colleagues said the following. Let me just read this to you. She said, "I went to a rural school that claimed to have electricity, but when we got there, we found it only had one plug. We were meant to charge 1,200 laptops from that one plug." I suppose that's interesting because one can have all the kind of conceptual ideas about what it is you want to achieve, but if there are practical difficulties like that, how do you get around that?
Well, there are many challenges every time that we are working with remote rural areas around the world or developing countries per se. Our focus is pretty much to work on development and to work on capacity building and to run out a plan much earlier before the laptops even reach the hands of the teachers and afterwards they're going to reach the hands of the kids. We do find situation where all the time, sometimes they're not even schools, so how can you even start when there's no building? So we do have a solution that allows the kids to work in an outdoor environment charged with solar panels or with human-powered devices, and you can get easy access among the laptops because the devices do get connected between each other without using internet.
Of course, Christopher, there's the whole concept of classroom learning, but of course you would seek to help in other areas as well. Let's take health policy, for example. What kind of technology projects are UNICEF involved as regards health?
Well, I think that the issues underlying changing and fixing broken national systems, whether they're health or education, are fairly similar. And if we talked about one principle earlier, which was that you have to build for scale, I think another principle which we adhere to in health and in looking at education and learning is that you have to build locally. We have to be able to find solutions with the people who need them. And if that means working with teachers and working with kids in a remote or rural area, we actually end up sidestepping the type of problems like getting there and then realizing that there's no electricity or only one plug. So what we've found over and over again is that when we can create systems where people design their own solutions and UNICEF can help to scale them, we create systems that are really sustainable long past our initial input or look at it. And in health systems, that can be anything from providing national scale nutritional surveillance through text messages in Malawi to the system that we recently built in Nigeria, which is now reporting on births in real time through the whole country of Nigeria using text messages and mobile phones.
René Whitmire at Intel, I mean, are you able to tailor your contribution so you're not just imposing a contribution?
So the key for us is really working with partners, and I think that's the essential for scaling some of the work, particularly when you're looking at difficult, challenging environments. We work with partners who understand local ecosystems, the cultural, social context, as well as the infrastructural constraints that we need to think about.
Okay, and now we're going to hear a short clip from a talk given at TED in 2010 by Dr. Sugata Mitra of the Hole in the Wall project. As Dr. Mitra explains, he was frustrated by the lack of IT training for teachers in rural India, and he decided on the following experiment.
I basically embedded a computer into a wall of a slum in New Delhi. The children barely went to school. They didn't know any English. They'd never seen a computer before. And they didn't know what the internet was. I connected high-speed internet to it. It's about 3 feet off the ground. Turned it on and left it there. This boy here in the middle of central India, this is in a Rajasthan village, where the children recorded their own music and then played it back to each other. And in the process, they enjoyed themselves thoroughly. They did all of this in 4 hours after seeing the computer for the first time. So at the end of it, we concluded that groups of children can learn to use computers and the internet on their own, irrespective of who or where they were.
That was Sugata Mitra, and that full talk is available on TED.com. So Dr. Mitra concludes that children can teach themselves basic IT skills. And with that in mind, let's talk about what a 21st century classroom might look like. Julia, how do you see classrooms in developing nations changing with advances in technology? Will we break the template?
Well, if you're looking at classrooms where there are no classrooms, where there are no schools, like open air environments in developing countries. And this is one of the latest research projects that Nicholas Negroponte, in conjunction with Harvard University and Tufts University in Boston, have been doing in Ethiopia for the last 10 months, a project that is called a reading project. Basically just parachuting tablets in a village and try to understand what the kids and the overall population was doing with those devices. What Sugata Mitra was saying is pretty much reinforcing the research that is coming out of this Ethiopian project that you might have heard earlier. We see the classrooms becoming more collaborative, with a more personalized learning, more child-centric. And it doesn't mean that the teacher is going to disappear. The teacher is going to become more a facilitator, somebody who will play a different role than what used to be in the past, but is still a key component to make sure that the overall educational process gets into place.
Christia Fabian, in your view, what do you think the 21st century classroom will look like?
I know that the classroom of the next 10 years will look nothing like the classroom of yesterday. And I think that's important for all of us to recognize that that's not a change that's going to happen only in places that are currently without electricity or currently without school structures, but in the sort of, quote, global north, close quote, as well. We know that technology is going to increase access to education and the quality of educational material. We know that sort of social networks can have created the ability to make enormous leaps in how we connect young people to each other. I think we can guess that the skills that we're teaching right now aren't really giving kids the type of opportunities that they need to be productive members of the workforce. And I think that finally we understand that real-time data will give us access to learning outcomes and information about how kids are interacting with learning material and how teachers are interacting with children in a much, much faster set of cycles than we've ever had previously. I think that the idea that you can, and Nick Negroponte has the ability to sort of elevate almost anything into the level of the absurd, but the idea that you can drop and parachute laptops into rural Ethiopia and get a sense of the future is sort of at best offensive and at worst unethical. But I do think that there's an ability for us to clearly look at what needs are and work with people who have those needs to construct the solutions to build the classroom of the future together.
Gavin Patterson, let me get a quick thought from you. When you close your eyes, what sort of 21st century classroom do you see?
I mean, speaking from our experience, it takes almost no time at all for a child or one of our students to, if you hand them an e-reader, they'll understand how to use it, you know, within 5 minutes. And our biggest problem is often training the teachers to a level where they're not embarrassed by how well their students understand the piece of technology they're supposed to be teaching with. And I think you're right. I think it's going to be much more student-centric. I think it'll be much more exploratory from the students' perspective. And I think the students will be able to connect across boundaries, you know, geographical boundaries, without even, you know, it will become second nature to them. And the teachers will have such a huge amount of information at their fingertips that they will probably become facilitators, and, you know, the education can be much more centralised and it can be homogenised to a much greater level when you've got this sort of connectivity. Although I have to say that in most of the areas we operate in, the connectivity is so poor, and although we use digital technology, it's going to be a long time coming. Not only is the connectivity poor, but the expense is enormous. The data costs really do prohibit any sort of connection over the internet or mobile networks, which is a real problem we're facing.
Renee Whitmire, give me your prediction and talk to me a bit about MOOCs, massive open online courses. What are they and how do they help?
So, and I agree. I think that what my colleagues have said about personalized learning, student-centric learning, and just the idea that the classroom can be transformed from this model of teachers standing and lecturing at students to much more student-directed, interactive, and engaging. We just actually finished some research looking at some of our Intel Teach programs, which is really about training teachers in India, Chile, and Jordan, and really found a difference not only for students in the way they're learning, but also teachers and the way they're approaching the classroom more broadly. this idea, I don't talk at students anymore. I'm really engaging them, interacting, and empowering them to learn.
Christopher, Fabian at UNICEF, if we are to see this kind of trend, what can businesses actually do to help that happen?
We see that there's an enormous opportunity to engage with business and private sector in all of the innovation work that UNICEF is doing, and I think that the space of learning and education is no different. For us, there's a clear shared value in the space of creating a knowledgeable and an excited workforce in the next generation. Giving children access to information is one thing. Giving them access to opportunity is the logical and necessary sort of next step. And so when we're working with big tech companies and we're asking them, you know, what skills would you like to see in your student, in your worker, what we never hear from them is like, well, we want a student who can pass a standardized test. Right? Nobody's looking for that when they're hiring. What they are saying is that they want people who can work together in groups, that they want people who understand what kind of an increasingly globalized world looks like, and that they want people who are able to be adaptable and agile in sort of how they approach problems. And I think, as Renee said, those are all skills that can be taught if we look at new ways of engaging kids in the learning process. That makes businesses be a really both exciting and important partner of ours when we're trying to develop the space around learning and education.
And Renee, does that sound like the kind of conversation that your company's happy to have?
Absolutely. We are very interested in that space of 21st century skills that can succeed in the economy. So things like both hard skills like technical digital literacy, but also those skills around self-confidence, critical thinking, being able to collaborate and work amongst social networks. Those are the types of skills that employers are looking for, and there's quite a big skills gap as of now. And so many of these efforts, I think, are pushing students into a place where they have better chances of employability.
Judith D'Amico, how are businesses working in tandem with one laptop per child?
We do believe that the employability skills are so important. That's why we have been always focused on the on trying to get more a collaborative approach among the students, let them work in a team environment and trying to cooperate together. And one of the issues that we're trying always to reinforce was precisely to teach them since at a very young age how to program. Because part of the programming is also incorporates all the skills of teamwork and collaboration, and we do work with many organizations, international organizations. We do work with many private sector. On one end, they are providing us knowledge and technology. On the other hand, they are providing us and they are helping us with content, monitoring, evaluation, teacher training. UNESCO is one of our global partners, as well as UNDP, ITU, and World Food Programme. And we work hands-on-hands to try to accelerate programs, specifically in developing countries.
But Christian Fabian, these are big challenges we've set ourselves. Do you think business is doing enough?
I think business can always do more. And I'm happy to have conversations, you know, with companies that are sort of global in scale and really forward-looking in thinking. We really see that the role that business can play with us is to help us follow a principled approach to designing solutions to these challenges. That really means that business needs to get to the point where the problem is to really have a lack of ego in designing the solutions, because as many of the people on this call have said, the discussions aren't going to, the answers aren't coming from any one place. And I think that when we see businesses, companies like Frog Design, who's given us so much of their time in thinking about big challenges in the health space, or ThoughtWorks, who works with us on designing solutions for family tracing and reunification, when we see these companies give their time, they give it in an open source manner, they give it in a way that's not creating a good only for a company, but is really creating a true public good. And I think that we see that that kind of openness and collaboration around the world's most pressing challenges is the only way to solve these things that affect hundreds of millions of people.
Gavin, I mean, is something like teacher training an area that businesses can become involved in? Because, you know, recently Samsung admitted to a practice of dumping laptops and then running away from them.
I think teacher training is so important. And, you know, often I'll be in a school and I'll hand a teacher an e-reader and they'll look at me as if I've just handed in my own head. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of great teachers out there who do champion a technology, but it's very hard for a generation of teachers who haven't grown up with the technology, and you know, the students they're teaching have mobile phones often, and they're very au fait with the technology. Some of our students, you know, have been known to read, you know, full physics textbooks on Mixit, an app on their phone, and you know they are really so far behind. And I think, yes, whether it's business or whether it's, you know, government funded or however it happens, I think the teacher training is absolutely crucial. But again, of course, it's just another problem, you know, amongst many problems that the schools face and the education systems face.
Well, I suppose once you're there, many problems become apparent. As I mentioned earlier, the Guardian's global development team have been writing recently about the unintended consequences of technology in developing countries. And in the comments section to those articles, someone called SkillsNG got in touch, and he said this: content development is hard. It requires dedication with an uncertain monetary outcome. We at the African Virtual School are battling on the content front. He says that unless hardware is targeted and in context, the content will be of very little use. Renee, are MOOCs being produced in developing countries, or is the rationale behind them being dominated by Western practices?
I think MOOCs in general are opening up, kind of liberalizing education at some point. I think it's always good to be cautious about hype behind things like big open systems. I think what's exciting is it's innovating, pushing the boundaries, opening and creating more access. I think what is always a challenge to me as a researcher is thinking about the sustainability, the relevance and longer term impact of accessing education in different ways like that.
And Christopher, obviously there's a benefit, but isn't there also a risk that this technology will have a negative impact on traditional teaching practices?
Well, I think there's always that risk, but you look at a country like Uganda, where you have about 60% of teachers who aren't in a classroom on a given day, and I wonder what the sort of the teaching practices are that are going to be impacted. If it's what we need to do is to figure out how to link the skills that technology can give to young people, whether that's a capacity to use social networks in ways that are better than their predecessors did, or a capacity to work together in new ways. I think we can look at those type of skills and figure out how to engage them on those platforms in a way that gives them a path to their future. And suddenly, if we can make the link between that and job skills, and learning becomes not only fun and exciting, but really useful as well, I think we create an environment where the MOOC, or whatever metaphor we're using in 5 years to talk about, you know, massive amounts of open, free content, where that becomes a vehicle to get kids through a learning cycle into a space where they can help decide their own future.
Okay, finally today, let's talk about a group that have been historically overlooked in education the world over: young women. Christopher, fill us in on some of the projects that UNICEF has been responsible for in that area.
We've been looking at, as UNICEF, in how we can engage sort of most vulnerable populations, particularly in developing their technology skills. One thing that's been apparent to UNICEF is that if we do invest in populations which are otherwise out of the normal education and learning loop, we can have far greater outcomes down the line, whether that's young women in places where it's difficult for them to get access to education, or children with disabilities who are often excluded from traditional learning. We know that putting our time and our money into those populations gives us a resonance across the spectrum of young people in that country. I think Girls Who Code is an example that's not a UNICEF project, but an example of great pushes in looking at how you can create powerful populations of learners and of young women who are able to really shape a discourse themselves, rather than having that shape put on them by an external system.
So of course there are benefits there, but of course there are hidden dangers associated with the internet as well. I mean, take this 2010 report by Plan International. It said that while ICTs seen by Brazilian girls as a major asset in their personal growth, with 84% owning a mobile phone, 50% said they would meet someone in person that they'd met online. I mean, Renee, if mobiles are so widely used, is there education to match this so that girls are also aware of the downside and the risks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're touching a really important point. So we actually released a report in early January of this year looking at the gender and technology gap. Specifically, we found that 23% fewer women than men are online in developing countries. And in places like sub-Saharan Africa, that grows to almost 45% fewer women than men. So there is a gap. When we found in our research that there was also a fear that when women get online, that there's risks in terms of safety and other things. However, we found that from a recommendations perspective, a holistic approach to promoting access to technologies coupled with familiarity, digital literacy training, public campaigns from governments around what is safety, changing cultural norms about what is acceptable for girls and women to do, all together is a really multi-stakeholder imperative to get more women access to and use of technologies and really thinking how that can be used in effective ways.
Julia, from your perspective, are governments taking this seriously, that particular issue of safety in the internet?
They do. It really depends on the countries. Regarding the overall girls' approach towards education and technology, we have great experiences from Nepal to India and Afghanistan, when we did a lot of lobbying towards the ministries of education to make sure that the girls were allowed also, even in different classrooms, to still partake and get education that was going beyond the standard curriculum, and we actually reinforced it with additional content on family planning and basic HIV prevention, malaria, major disease prevention, and nutritional awareness.
Thanks for that. Finally, before we came on air, I asked you all to think about one thing that your industries could look to do to make a sustainable digital economy for developing nations. And Gavin, I'm going to start with you. What can business do?
Well, I think that looking at it from quite a narrow perspective, my one thought was really looking at devices and hardware available. I think they're all a product of a business model which works very well in the Western world, or sort of the developed world rather. They're based on the premise that you have more than one device, they're reliant on Wi-Fi, you don't fix them, you just replace them. And I think really if there's going to be a serious drive forward, I think a new business model is required. I think we need to get to the stage where products are being developed to make money in developing countries. And that may mean revisiting and using a completely different business model.
Julia, if there's a magic thread, if there's one priority, what would that be?
We do hope that the overall world gets education. We do believe that universal education needs to be reached at some point. It's not going to be reached by 2015 as planned by the Millennium Development Goals, but we do believe it's the roots for any development for any nation and for democratization process as well.
Renee, the same question to you. If there was one thing to help a sustainable digital economy for developing nations, what would it be?
I would say for technology companies to really think about their core competencies and partner with groups that really know the local environments and contexts, and where we can really leverage that shared value space of both creating social value as well as business value.
And finally, Christopher, what's on the top of your in tray at UNICEF?
I think UNICEF is an international organization with 135 country offices and an ability to really see these solutions arise at a hyper-local level that fits specific contexts. And what I hope and see UNICEF doing in the next year is being able to raise those issues that are open source, that are scalable and sustainable to a global level, and be able to share the learnings that we're seeing coming out of the great innovations in the global south so that we can help to change the space of education and learning around the world.
Well, great ideas, great optimism. Thank you all for your time, but we are out of time. My thanks to our guests, Christopher Fabian, Gavin Patterson, Renee Whitmire, and Julia D'Amico. My name is Hugh Muir. The producer was Matt Hill. Thank you all for listening.
And that's all we have for you this week. To comment on this podcast, just go to guardian.co.uk/sustainablebusiness. Of course, for breaking tech news day and night, go to guardian.co.uk/tech. Again, this podcast was produced by Matt Hill. But from me, Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Thursday, so do join us. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.